Talking History with Patrick Gagan. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Leute, Argus.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, to mark the 300th anniversary of the publication of one of the most influential books ever written, we'll be discussing the history of Gulliver's Travels, and we'll be finding out how Jonathan Swift created one of the landmarks of world literature. You can send us your thoughts and comments to talkinghistory@newstalk.com. First published in 1726, Gulliver's Travels is a landmark of world literature. Its savage satire continues to shape literature, politics, comedy, and even the language we use today, from Lilliputian to Yahoo. But Gulliver's Travels is far darker, stranger, and more radical than many people remember from childhood. Beneath the tiny people and giant kingdoms lies a devastating critique of politics, empire, science, reason, and human nature itself. And so in tonight's show, we'll explore why Jonathan Swift wrote the book, why it still matters, and how a Dublin clergyman created a masterpiece that continues to provoke readers around the world. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Daniel Cook is Professor of English and Scottish Literature at the University of Dundee and is an award-winning scholar of 18th and 19th century Scottish, Irish and English literature. He's an expert on Jonathan Swift, whose books include The Cambridge Companion to Gulliver's Travels and an edition of Gulliver's Travels, and his new book Gulliver's Afterlives, 300 Years of Transmedia Adaptation, has just been published. Tonight's show is inspired by Gulliver 300, a wonderful new exhibition at Marsh's Library that explores the enduring legacy of Swift and his most celebrated work. And we're delighted to be joined by Dr. Jason McGilligott, the director of Marsh's Library. He's an expert on early modern print culture, and he's currently completing a book on white-collar crime in 18th century Dublin. Dr. Clina O'Gallagher lectures in the School of English and Digital Humanities at UCC and is an expert on children's literature and women's writing and constructions of gender and sexuality in Irish writing in the 18th century. She's published extensively on Swift, and her chapter, The Early Novel for Children, will be published in the Cambridge History of Children's Literature in English later this year. Professor David Kenny is Professor in Law at Trinity College Dublin and is an expert in Irish and comparative constitutional law, critical legal theory and law and literature, and his brilliant detective work on Swift's epitaph features in the current issue of The New Yorker. Well, you're all very welcome. And Daniel, I might begin with you, and I might begin with, I suppose, who the book was aimed at. Because I think if I was on the train and I saw someone reading Gulliver's Travels, I might think, oh, I wonder why that adult is reading a children's book. But of course, it wasn't written as a children's book.
No, absolutely. In many ways, it has become a children's book, or perhaps even more so, a multimedia text. Think of all the films, comic books, adaptations. It very much is one of those great works that has been adapted in any conceivable format. Audiobooks, actually, it works very well. The initial audience, it's fair to say, was humanity. It is a book that cuts to the quick. It's a satire on all aspects of who we are or who we think we are. It's a takedown of the pettiness of politicians, a perennial evergreen topic, of course, in many ways. It's an attack on contemporary science. It's a very learned book written by a very learned man at the height of his satirical powers. Jonathan Swift is pushing 60 when he works on this book. He does see it as his great life's work, and it's aimed at anyone who wishes to know more about the human condition and our limitations as much as our achievements. It's a satire in all the best possible ways. It enriches, but also completely eviscerates any sense of human pride.
And Daniel, I wonder if Jonathan Swift was to have the benefit of time travel and appear in the year 2026, do you think he would be shocked at the way this book has become such a global phenomenon? Would he be astonished at how something that was intended as this sharp satire is now a much loved text that gets turned into cartoons and films and various different adaptations?
I think it's fair to say he would be somewhat bemused, bearing in mind for Swift, satire was very much a tool for the present, for the current circumstances. I think he'd be quite saddened, depressed even, to feel his satire still had relevance today. He'd perhaps be quite shocked that we still have, you know, petty politics going on, lack of reform in some ways. Like any great satirist, Swift wanted to improve the world. He very famously said, the whole point of Gulliver's Travels is to vex the world rather than divert it. He didn't want to entertain so much as change humanity. So here we are 300 years later, not much has changed. That's quite dispiriting for a satirist with such a purpose as Swift. Although, perhaps like any author, any creative person, perhaps slightly tickled to find people reading comic book versions and watching films of Gulliver's Travels. I don't think he was very precious about his intellectual property. I think he was quite keen for people to engage with his work. So I think a mixture of bemusement and perhaps sadness.
Amusement and perhaps sadness. Jason, I think the idea of doing an exhibition around Gulliver's Travels is an absolutely brilliant one, and capturing and tapping into that 300th anniversary. So tell us about Gulliver 300, the inspiration behind the idea, what people can see, and how this connects with the texts and the books that Swift himself would have been familiar with.
Gulliver 300 really comes from sort of the feeling that is necessary really to sort of celebrate for the 300th anniversary this fantastic text, but also make it accessible to as wide a public as possible. So what we've tried to do is bring Swift alive as a man who lived beside the library, as Dean of St. Patrick's Cathedral, as a man who read frequently in the library, and then was also frequently in the library as a trustee and governor of the institution, as somebody who would, if he could come back and time travel, as you mentioned earlier, if he came into the library, he would recognise it down to the bookshelves and even the shape of the books on the shelves. They're all in the same place 300 years later. So it is conceivable that his ghost coming back could, without going to the catalogue, pick down the books that we know he was reading in the 1710s, 1720s and 1730s when he was a frequent visitor to the library. So we wanted to bring him alive, and we wanted to bring his book to life as well. So what we've done is we've displayed a number of the first editions. So it's always useful to show the physical copy of the first edition from 1726 printed in London, as well as the first edition in Dublin in 1735. But then we've also shown a range of different texts. So, you know, the first French translation in 1727. It's really interesting how quickly the book is translated into different languages. A German edition in 1731. So it's very quickly becomes very popular and very well known. David Garrick, for example, does an edition of a one-act play based on Lilliput, which we're showing there. And then we're showing a whole range of... The other interesting thing is how people have engaged with it. So a whole range of very finely and beautifully illustrated editions of the text from the 19th and the 20th century. And then we're having a little bit of fun with it as well. So you can't talk about Jonathan Swift and Gulliver's Travels without really talking about the politics of it as well. But we're trying to do that in as light a touch a way as possible. So there are very weighty themes there. So if you think about a modest proposal from 1729, we were thinking about how would you display it? How would you explain something as complex as that? You know, and we thought we might have big panels up explaining what the concept of irony is, or satire, you know, and saying he's not really serious on this. There's a there's a sort of an edge to the text, but one of my colleagues came up with the inspired idea of displaying a modest proposal on top of a dining plate, a very fine, fancy dining plate with knives and forks on either side. So we're trying to kind of introduce people to Swift and to this text. And if they come away only knowing a few things, that Swift was Irish, very many visitors to Ireland won't know that, that he was a Dubliner, that he was a frequent visitor to the library, then that's very useful. And I've heard people who are visiting the exhibition talking about it as they're leaving sometimes. And sometimes a couple of people have said, I only really remember it from reading it to the kids. And they hadn't really thought about it as an adult's book. So hopefully a number of people will go away and read the book for themselves.
And you said there about how quickly it became popular, and of course we know it's hugely popular today. But do you know why? Why, like, if we had the secret to writing a bestseller, we'd all be millionaires. You know, there's a certain magic there that it's hard to tap into that. So what is it about it that captured the imagination 300 years ago, but has been capturing imaginations ever since?
Well, I think it's a mixture of there's a gentle mocking humour as well as a biting satire as well. And one of the tricks in any sort of satire is that you need to be able to hide the direct objects whom you are attacking in general terms. So just for legal reasons, because you could find yourself in very serious trouble if you're attacking the king or the queen and the high treasurer and so on. But if you can do that in a general way, which can speak in general terms to faults in society, I think that's very effective. And the story as well plays with perspective. So children will really like it just because, you know, the idea of children will always have that sense of the land of the giants, you know, that all children are Gulliver in the land of the giants, and they'll understand some of what's going on there. So, for example, if I might read a little bit of the novel, when Gulliver is in the land of the giants, there's quite an exciting passage. And again, you might think sometimes it's political, it's satire, it's quite dry. Here's a passage which describes what it might be like to be a small person in a big person's world. And he says, I remember one morning when the little girl had set me in my box upon the window. So he's a tiny person in the giant's world, as she usually did in fair days, to give me air. And after I had lifted up one of the sashes on the window in the box and sat down at my table to eat a piece of sweet cake for my breakfast, above 20 wasps, allured by the smell, came flying into the room, humming louder than the drones of as many bagpipes. Some of them seized my cake and carried it piecemeal away. Others flew about my head and face, confounding me with the noise and putting me in the utmost terror of their stings. However, I had the courage to rise and draw my sword and attack them in the air. I dispatched four of them, but the rest got away, and I presently shut my window. These insects were as large as partridges. I took out their stings, found them an inch and a half long and as sharp as needles.
Brilliant. Cliona, you were teaching Gulliver's Travels for your undergraduate students this semester, and I was wondering, how did they respond to the text?
Yeah, well, it's always great to teach Swift because he confounds students' expectations about texts that are written in what are admittedly pretty distant periods, you know, more distant for them than for me, but still a very distant period. Because they tend to have an assumption that things that are written, you know, long, long ago will be stuffy and somehow conventional. You know, they're very young, so they tend to have an idea that things become, you know, more radical as time goes on. So Swift has fantastic shock value for students, which is always very useful when you're teaching. And, you know, they're particularly shocked, for example, by his notoriously like scatological imagination, the fact that he offers like truly grotesque descriptions of the human body, that he is incredibly vulgar. But they're also very shocked by what seems to be his particularly for them now, if it was 20 years ago, it wouldn't be the same, that he has this, what appears like a prescient critique of technological overreach. And that stuns and amazes them. Daniel mentioned, you know, that he has satires of scientific abstract thought. And he's also very skeptical about the power of reason. It was conventional in the 18th century to call man a rational animal or human beings rational animals. And Swift famously said, you know, this, he didn't believe this. He believed and said that human beings were capable of reason, that we weren't in fact defined by reason, and that he saw us much more as much more fallible, much more limited. And he was hugely skeptical of the scientific revolution of the late 17th and early 18th century. And so in book three of Gulliver's Travels, which for some people is like the least coherent or successful book, but it has this extraordinary timely critique of technology, basically. So he satirizes the Royal Society, which was established in London in the 17th century, and he calls it the Royal Academy of Projectors. And he describes these absolutely absurd experiments. So famously, an experiment to extract sunlight from cucumbers, an experiment to make food from excrement, so the waste of food to become food. But what is most stunning these days in book three is that he describes what he calls an engine for producing text. And it's a mechanical engine, not a digital engine, but he gives an elaborate description of it. It's a big wooden frame with loads of blocks, and these are turned by young interns, basically, and it randomly produces text. And they're proudly showing this to Gulliver, the projectors, and what they say about it is, and it's extraordinary. He says, a project for improving speculative knowledge by practical and mechanical operations. And he goes so far as to say, everyone knew how laborious the usual method is of attaining to arts and sciences, whereas by his contrivance, the most ignorant person, at a reasonable charge and with a little bodily labour, might write books in philosophy, poetry, politics, laws, mathematics and theology without the least assistance from genius or study. Which is, you know, pretty much what ChatGPT is telling us, or any of the, you know, generative AI large language models are telling us that they can do today. And what's really interesting about this is that this was coming, in a sense, from a very reactionary place for Swift. He was horrified by what we would call the democratization of language, literacy and print. So, you know, this is the start of the print revolution. Print materials are becoming much more cheap, more accessible, literacy levels are increasing, more people are becoming writers. And Swift was quite elitist. You know, Daniel was saying he's a very learned man. And he just foresaw, you know, this flood of like nonsense coming to the printing press. And we know, of course, that this was a really positive development, this huge widening and expansion and democratization of knowledge and brought all kinds of benefits. But in a sense, Swift sort of met himself coming back, and we are now, I think, where he feared we would end up, which is literally a kind of a flood of mechanically produced nonsense. So he's an extraordinary figure because his imagination was so powerful that it kind of goes way beyond the kind of ideological constructs of his thinking. You know, he is somebody who is in some ways very defined by who he is and where he is and what time he was born in. And in other ways, he kind of transcends those as well. Yeah, it's really, he's an extraordinary figure and endlessly, I think, surprising and fascinating for students.
David, you've just finished a draft article about Gulliver's Travels and law and literature. And I wonder, what is it about Swift that has interested you or caught your imagination so much and that you've become so passionate about?
Yeah, I think a lot of it has been touched upon by everyone else's contributions, because this is what's extraordinary about Swift, what Leanna was just saying, this kind of extraordinary prescience about large language models and, you know, the producing text in this way. Swift also kind of anticipates the capital investment that requires by saying the model would be so much better and produce so much more work if we're only 500 times larger, and the projectors just need money to make a bigger one, and then it will be even more extraordinary. And when you go to read Gulliver's Travels, you know, as people have said, you expect a book that will read very much of its time, and there is all this commentary on the Whigs and the Tories and the various quabbles of church and state in that time, but you find immediate parallels to your own moment. You find that the faults that Swift is pointing out in politics, in people, in our pride, they are, as he said in one of his poems, you know, the fault is in mankind. This is something that is going to transcend his own time and continue. And on top of that, you just have an amazing work of fiction, something that is exciting and gross and consistently surprising. So when I went back to read it for other Jonathan Swift projects and revisited it, and I hadn't read it probably in 20 years, I realized that it was an extraordinary work of comparative constitutional law, that Jonathan Swift is going around the fictional world comparing the British Constitution to constitutions he's invented to critique what he's finding at home, but also to suggest other ways of governing, other worlds that we could live in, other ways that we might be. And I realized that this was also an exercise in law and literature. Swift is exploring the capacity of law and also how bad lawyers are, because he hates lawyers probably more than almost anything else, through the medium of fiction and through the medium of the kind of the burgeoning medium of the novel, which he's helping to potentially invent as he's writing. And it's something that I had not appreciated when I'd read it previously. It was first read to me in some abridged version as a child by my father, and I'd always loved it, and I'd revisited it and loved it again. And I somehow feel that every time you go back, you find new layers to Swift and you find something that resonates with your interests or your moment that you didn't expect to find.
And I was really struck by something Jason said about how so many visitors aren't even aware that Swift is Irish. And I wonder, are we missing a trick in terms of tourism and marketing and the great canon of Irish writers in doing more to talk about Swift?
I think that the problem is that Swift, while such an amazing figure, is also a complicated one. He was an Irish person who had complex feelings about being Irish and about Ireland, a patriot who hated his country is one of the ways he's been described. And, you know, I don't know if that's quite right. He hated the way that Ireland was being treated. He didn't feel as at home here as he had when he lived in London. And he comes from a tradition and a time that Irish history doesn't talk about terribly well. I think that this period of British history and Irish history is something that doesn't exist in the public consciousness. And some of the things that Swift is most famous for, the Drapier letters, say, where he railed against the issuing of Wood's half pence, this sort of debased money in Ireland, this extraordinary both literary and political achievement to write these pamphlets that essentially bring down a major plank of British policy. That's not something I think that many people have an active awareness of, because that period of history is not something that we discuss terribly regularly, and people in Dublin don't know, I think, about Swift's contribution, and that the people of Dublin lit bonfires on his birthday to celebrate him after those letters. So I think there's an awful lot more we could do to work Jonathan Swift into the story of Dublin and the story of Irish history, because he infuses this city. On my way walking to the studio here, I pass by houses just beside St. Patrick's Cathedral, where there are bas reliefs of scenes from Gulliver's Travels carved into the buildings. He's all over the place, and you really can't avoid him if you know where to look. And I think we could definitely do a better job telling that story.
Well, tonight we are talking about Jonathan Swift and Gulliver's Travels, and we're going to be back with more on his use of languages in the book and various adaptations after this. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about Gulliver's Travels on this, the 300th anniversary of its publication. My brilliant panel of experts, Professor Daniel Cook, who's Professor of English and Scottish Literature at the University of Dundee. He's an award-winning scholar of 18th and 19th century Scottish, Irish and English literature, and is an expert on Jonathan Swift. And his books include The Cambridge Companion to Gulliver's Travels, an edition of Gulliver's Travels, and his new book, Gulliver's Afterlives, 300 Years of Transmedia Adaptation, has just been published. Dr. Jason McElligott is the director of Marsh's Library and is an expert on early modern print culture. And there is that wonderful exhibition, Gulliver 300, that is taking place in Marsh's Library until September. Dr. Cliona O'Gallagher lectures in the School of English and Digital Humanities at UCC and is an expert on children's literature and women's writing and constructions of gender and sexuality in Irish writing in the long 18th century. She's published extensively on Swift, and her chapter, The Early Novel for Children, will be published in the Cambridge History of Children's Literature in English later this year. Professor David Kenny is professor in law at Trinity College Dublin and is an expert in Irish and comparative constitutional law, critical legal theory, and law and literature. And his brilliant detective work on Swift's epitaph features in the current issue of The New Yorker. Daniel, we might talk about Swift's position as Dean of St. Patrick's, because I wonder what led him there, what he made of that important position, and I suppose how difficult it was for him to juggle all of these different responsibilities where he's getting involved in controversies, he's writing these hugely important books, and then he also has the role of Dean to think about.
Yes, I think it's fair to say Swift greatly appreciated the importance of his position as the Dean of St. Patrick's Cathedral. And in many ways, he went full circle, born in Dublin, but he did spend some of his young adulthood in England. You know, he pursued his master's degree in Oxford, having studied at Trinity College Dublin. He was quite keen to pursue a career. He was Anglican. He was quite keen to pursue a position in the English church, and was very cross, actually, very unhappy not to be appointed to the absolutely key role of Archbishop and under Queen Anne. Queen Anne died quite selfishly, so Swift had to return to Ireland. And initially, with great reluctance, I think it's fair to say, he referred to coming back to Dublin as returning like a rat in the hole. But of course, as a satirist, there's a bit of tongue-in-cheek there. It's fair to say Swift was very much a product of Dublin culture, took his role very seriously, and was, by all accounts, a very good dean of the cathedral, spent a lot of time with the poorer members of the community, was very open about exploring the more deprived areas of Dublin and the surrounding areas. That kept him very busy, of course, and he was very keen to keep up his literary works. By the time he writes Gulliver's Travels, he's pushing 60. It takes him about 4 to 5 years to complete this work. Publishes it anonymously, which is not uncommon for any satirist, let alone Swift. But as word got around about this wonderful, quite terrifying text, he began to sort of steer into it a bit more and sort of revel in his position as the author of Gulliver's Travels. But he never forgot his parish. He never forgot the people of Dublin that he served. And I think it's quite telling that the cathedral displays him quite prominently alongside Stella, Esther Johnson, possibly the great love of his life.
And it's interesting when we talk about his politics, how later in his life he described himself as a Hibernian patriot. But as David was saying earlier, you know, that perhaps wasn't always the case. And very complex political views, and that kind of adds to the level of complexity when discussing him.
Absolutely. There's a lot of heated scholarship around Swift's politics. Like any great satirist, he kind of played both sides in many ways. Without being reductive, we might refer to him, as many scholars have, as a Tory anarchist. And in many ways, he did kind of enjoy being on the outside. So by the time that Queen Anne has died and we have the Whig ascendancy, I think Swift kind of enjoyed being in the sort of opposition camp, as it were. He wasn't always a Tory. As a young man, he was what he referred to as an old Whig in many ways. So he did kind of flip-flop in his political views. But religion was always very central to him, and that really mattered to him. I think that's why he was quite taken with the Tories opposed to the Whigs, because of their much more religious position, as it were.
There are so many different adaptations of Gulliver's Travels, and animated versions and television versions and film versions. Richard Harris in a film in the 1970s, Jack Black more recently, Ted Danson in a miniseries. And what do you make of the different adaptations and how they, I suppose, reimagine and reinvent the world of Gulliver's Travels?
Yes, there have been so many film adaptations of Gulliver's Travels alone, and you just get a sense of the range. So Jack Black has appeared as Gulliver in the most recent version, a big 3D Hollywood version, which is very much aimed at children. It just adapts the first book, so Lilliput, and it's very much a vehicle for Jack Black's, you know, sort of clownish approach to the character. You get more thoughtful adaptations. Ted Danson in the mid-90s played this a bit more thoughtful version of the text and really steered into sort of the period piece, as it were, and does adapt all four books of Gulliver's Travels. But also, there are also lots of quirky versions of Gulliver's Travels on screen, particularly of Gulliver. Perhaps people don't know this, but Gulliver has appeared in both Star Trek and Star Wars, amongst other things. He sort of cameos as a character in many surprising places. And that's just films. If we think about video games, he's appeared in video games, comic books, including Marvel Comics. So Gulliver has appeared in Marvel Comics alongside the superheroes that we now associate with Marvel Comics. Graphic novelists, particularly great satirists such as Martin Rowson and Alan Moore, who's perhaps the more famous satirist of the two, you'd recognise those as quite powerful, potent, creative graphic satirists. Even from the very beginning, William Hogarth, great 18th century London graphic satirist and one of the sort of early pioneers of what we now recognise as the comic book, was also really taken with Gulliver's Travels. He produced his own adaptation, strangely, before the book was even published, which is remarkable. So just before it was published, he produced this satire based on the Lilliputian scenes.
Do you think the name Gulliver itself helps in its success? It's not a common name. You know, we don't call people Gulliver. If it was John's Travels, it wouldn't have the same resonance at all.
Absolutely. And again, there's a lot of scholarship on this. Gulliver, is it a play on words? Gulliver, it sounds like gullible. That's a bit of a stretch, maybe. Gull is an old word meaning to be gullible. There are also a family of Gullivers buried in Oxford, in a churchyard quite near to where Swift studied. So perhaps he just, took a day trip to the local graveyard. Oh, that's an interesting name. I'm also thinking that the name Lemuel, it being so unusual, that there's just something quite buffoonish about it. And I think that's kind of what Swift is going for. Lemuel Gulliver is a very pompous character. He's not a likable narrator. He goes to all these various places, and he doesn't really learn his lessons. In fact, he doubles down on his own snobbery in many ways. And so I think the name perfectly captures that sort of comical pride of Gulliver.
Jason, one thing I do like about Gulliver, though, is that he seems to embrace the languages of the places that he visits. And there are so many different languages in the book. And he's certainly not one of these tourists who insists on just doing things his own way.
No, and it's interesting that despite what Daniel says about his snobbery and his haughtiness, which is absolutely true, he can't like as the hero of a 19th or 20th century English travel novel or a science fiction novel assume that he will turn up in any place on the earth or any place in space and be able to speak very slowly and clearly in English and be understood. So what we're seeing here is that Gulliver's Travels is written at a time in which Britain hasn't yet become the preeminent military and economic power in the world. And it is just beginning to move from being just another small European power, a small island off the extremity of Europe. So it's really interesting to me that Swift is very clear that Gulliver speaks a series of languages. So he obviously speaks English, but he speaks French as well. He speaks Spanish. He speaks Italian. He speaks Dutch. And of course, he would have to because William of Orange, the King of England from 1689, 1690 onwards, is a Dutchman who had invaded England. And when the book is published, George I is a German. So England is a small, not yet preeminent power. So there is this understanding that if you are going to go out into the world as an English voyager, as an English traveller, you have to engage with the world as it is. And that's part of the background, I think, which is quite interesting as to how there is this assumption that Gulliver, wherever he goes, whether it's Lilliput or Brobdingnag or Laputa or the land of the horses, he sets about learning diligently the languages of the people with whom he interacts. And it's quite interesting that certainly nowadays our assumption is that if people from different cultures anywhere in the world, if a Japanese person meets a Bolivian and an Indonesian, if they can, they will speak English. But here we're in a world before that, before the preeminence of England and the English language. And the way in which he applies himself with rigor to learning those languages tells us something, I think, about contemporary English society in the early 18th century. There can be no way in which you would assume you would travel the world using English only.
And your exhibition will be traveling because it'll be off to Paris in the autumn.
Yes, we're going to Paris from the 17th of September to the middle of November. We're bringing the exhibition to the Irish Cultural Centre, and that's part of long-standing relations with the Irish Cultural Centre, but it's also because Ireland in the second half of this year has the presidency of the EU, and it was felt that it would be useful to display a world-leading part of Irish culture in France and in Paris, so people there can see something of Irish culture and Irish literature, and also think about the ways in which that Irish literature has been translated into French and other languages and other European languages, and has been read all across Europe from the very earliest days.
Cliona, Gulliver's Travels is a wonderful example of travel literature, but I was surprised to see that actually Swift himself was trying to parody some of the existing travel literature of his time.
Yeah, exactly. I think a few of the other contributors have mentioned, you know, his skepticism about various different aspects of the modern world as it was unfolding around him. And in Gulliver's Travels, obviously, is a satire, and one of the things that makes satire work often is when you parody a specific form. So Gulliver's Travels is parodying two things. I mean, it's not just doing this, but it's parodying travel literature, but it's also partly parodying Defoe's Robinson Crusoe, which itself was inspired by forms of travel literature. So famously, Gulliver gives all these like long-winded, incredibly dull, and often not very accurate details about sailing and geographical directions and things that I don't understand. And Swift was just basically pretty bored, I think, by a lot of what other 18th century people were fascinated by, which was kind of like the power of empirical detail and empirical observation. So this was kind of a way of knowing that was sweeping the modern world. And the idea of tracking and noting and listing, which is very important in travel literature, is also really very important in Robinson Crusoe. He just thought it was really absurd and really, really boring. So he's partly parodying that. But there's a deeper sort of underlying kind of ideological insight there, which is those ways of knowing and those ways of describing and documenting were also being used then, I suppose, as knowledge, as a way of dominating and controlling. So I think both Jason and Daniel have noted that this was the start of England emerging as a global power. And those types of ways of looking at the world would become incredibly important. Knowledge is just as important as, you know, guns and manpower if you're going to control the world. So it's another way in which the text seems, again, sort of remarkably sort of radical and prescient, that he has this critique of those texts, those perspectives on the world, and that sort of very complacent idea that you know, you venture forth, you explore, you chart, you document, and that gives you then a form of, intellectual ownership over territories and peoples. So it's another thing that makes the text just so incredibly interesting and readable today.
And we're not at the centre of that world.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really, what Jason said is completely true, that there is no assumption in the text that the Englishman will be universally understood. But like Swift takes it much further. Like he really destabilizes that perspective, the English man abroad perspective, because he's constantly being subjected to these kind of radical shifts in perspective. He's always being viewed as the object. Like when he's tiny, you know, in Brobdignag, he's literally studied, you know, through a microscope. But even in Lilliput, when he's, you know, he's huge and he's really quite threatening, they're also studying him. You know, they inventory the objects in his pockets and they speculate about, you know, what he is. So it's kind of the opposite of what you would expect, that, you know, he's going out to kind of give his perspective on the world. He becomes, in a sense, the object of scrutiny in an awful lot of these places.
Well, tonight we are talking about Gulliver's Travels on this, the 300th anniversary of its publication. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be talking about Swift's epitaph and the legacy of Gulliver's Travels. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about Gulliver's Travels. I'm rejoined by my panel of experts, Professor Daniel Cook, Professor of English and Scottish Literature at the University of Dundee, and his new book, Gulliver's Afterlives, 300 Years of Transmedia Adaptation, has just been published. Dr. Jason McGilligott is the director of Marsh's Library, and there's a wonderful new exhibition running there, Gulliver 300. Dr. Cliona O'Gallagher, who lectures in the School of English and Digital Humanities at UCC and who has published extensively on Swift, and Professor David Kenny, who's professor in law at Trinity College Dublin and an expert on law and literature. David, I want to talk to you about the current issue of The New Yorker, because I rarely get jealous, but I was hugely jealous to read this article, not by you, but about you and this remarkable piece of detective work you've done on Swift's epitaph. And I'm not jealous because of the detective work. I'm jealous because this is the kind of article that gets turned into a Hollywood movie with a young Hugh Grant playing the academic. And it creates a whole new mega career for the person. So how did this all come about?
Yeah, well, crucially, I'm going to be playing myself in the Hollywood adaptation. Just going to insist upon that. Yeah, it's a very funny sort of story. I'd actually visited Marsh's Library, Jason's wonderful establishment, about a year ago. And later that day, I went to dinner. And one of my friends who knew where I'd been said, you know, why were you in Marsh's Library? What were you looking at? And I said, I'm doing this sort of very strange research on Swift's epitaph. And they said, you need to tell us all about this. So I probably spent about half an hour, 40 minutes boring my friends with the ins and outs of my kind of absurd theory. And one of the people at that dinner happened to be a staff writer for The New Yorker and said, I want to write about this. So that's how it came about. And so for the last 6 or 7 years, I've been spending a strange amount of my free time looking at a question that I am interested in, but very few other people are, which is whether or not Jonathan Swift's epitaph in St. Patrick's Cathedral, which has always been read as quite serious and lofty and grand, is in some sort of way a joke. Because almost everything Swift wrote was both serious on some level, but a deep and coded joke on another. And so I have been on a strange academic side quest, very far from even law and literature, looking at what Swift might have meant.
And how the tunes may have been moved around during Reconstruction, and that it may actually be a dig at our old friend Marsh of Marsh's Library fame.
Yeah, so my current kind of leading theory is that Swift was doing a number of things in the epitaph, but one of them was having a go at poor Narcissus Marsh, great founder of Marsh's Library, whom, for reasons that aren't entirely clear, Swift really disliked. He was just a person whom Swift took an immediate dislike to. He said in a very mean kind of comment he wrote about him that he was one of the only people to have the advantages of learning, wealth and opportunity and never to become a great man. He said that it was good not to be seated near him at a dinner party, both because apparently he had bad body odour, but also because he was a poor conversationalist. So Swift really just did not rate Marsh. And Marsh has, in the cathedral, a very large and quite loquacious epitaph about all his achievements, which, to be fair, he didn't write himself, but that paint Marsh as this very great figure. And I think that Swift wanted to satirise this by having an epitaph that was quite not loquacious, quite short and sort of almost challenged people to be great persons in a way that he felt maybe that Marsh wasn't. And the epitaphs were supposed to go side by side. Swift insisted on it in his will, and they were initially installed side by side. But then when the cathedral was reconstructed in the 1860s, they were moved apart by Benjamin Lee Guinness, who didn't know perhaps they were supposed to be together. And so the monuments were scattered and the joke was ruined. That's my current theory.
There are some wonderful works that are very much of their time, and they haven't really dated particularly well, and it's hard to really kind of connect with them in the way that audiences at the time would. And it seems to me that part of the genius of Swift is that it speaks to us in the 21st century. It has messages that are as relevant today as they were then. They're perhaps even more relevant today, that the satire still comes through and holds, and the fire and the passion, and there is something timeless about it, which is why every new generation can reinvent it and find their own Gulliver.
Right, and I think that the discussion we were having about language and about the nascent empire, Swift, you know, toward the end of Gulliver's Travels, has one of the most extraordinary critiques of empire that has ever been written, even as the empire was sort of still being built. He talks about the fact that really should these lands be conquered by Great Britain in order to civilize them? And he says, well, empires tend to do a lot of, you know, raping and looting and pillaging and leave the land, laden with blood. But of course not the British Empire, which is perfect and would never do any such thing and simply spreads religion and good governance all over the world. And there's an incredible satirical bite, and Swift could write that almost, you know, hundreds of years before the full effects of colonialism and the full lash of what the British Empire could do to different parts of the world would be fully appreciated. So he is timeless in that way, because he is always thinking about how human faults may look to us in future as full of folly and great mistakes.
Daniel, I think tonight's show may inspire some of our listeners to read the full version themselves and take so much out of it. Perhaps get one of the abridged version for kids and see how they'll enjoy it. And I wonder, are there other works by Swift that you would also recommend for us?
Yes, Swift's highly prolific, of course, and pretty much wrote satires on anything that you might imagine. I think that if there's one of his works that I would strongly urge people to read, because it is just so brilliant and it is so Swiftian and it's just perfect in many ways, is his verses on the death of Dr. Swift. He wrote his own self-elegy. It just gives you a sense of this man's morbid, dry Irish humour. And in this self-elegy, he imagines his friends and enemies at his funeral, and it's just a wonderful drama of how we might imagine ourselves and imagine our accomplishments, and it's just a wonderful piece of work. For those readers interested in perhaps religious satire, which is not a dry subject in the hands of Swift, A Tale of a Tub is just a wonderful piece of literature in that regard. Immodest Proposal, which is perhaps better known in Ireland, is just arguably the most powerful satire written in the English language. It's just so compelling, powerful, and it really, really cuts to the quick. It's a wonderful piece of work. I think Swift as a poet is very underrated. He had the misfortune, I guess, of being best friends with the greatest English poet of the age, Alexander Pope, who was a wonderful craftsman. But Swift had his own sort of comical style and almost limerick-like, very funny, very learned. He was deeply invested in classical poetry. And it's just a wonderful area of his work that is kind of neglected. So Swift the poet, there's loads of wonderful collections of his poems. His other prose satires, A Tale of a Tub, A Modest Proposal, are perhaps the most famous ones. But I would say Verses on the Death of Dr. Swift is just a wonderful piece of work. And I think it had a big influence on Joyce, by the way, thinking of other great Dublin authors, and George Orwell, another great satirist. It's just a wonderful piece of work.
Cliona, it's an incredible legacy for Swift and an incredible legacy for Gulliver's Travels itself. And the idea that 300 years on, we can discuss a book that everyone's heard of, you know, a lot of people will have seen at least some of a particular adaptation or version. People will be familiar with it from childhood. People know the name. It really is quite extraordinary.
It is. And what I say to my students, which may also be useful for anyone who's thinking of picking up Gulliver's Travels, the full version for the first time, is focus on what interests you, because there may be, you know, references to specific, you know, politicians that, you know, you don't need to go and read the footnotes. But there is so much in it that is really funny, really quite shocking, often very dark. Like, you know, he really was somebody who explored human beings, you know, not just their kind of funny failures, but also their darker sides. And, you know, on any, as you were saying, on any given day or week or year, something in it might strike you very forcibly. So it could be the humor, it could be the vulgarity, it could be the horror that is actually particularly in book four. And there nobody would be bored. There's something in it that is going to strike you. So that's what I would say. Focus on the things that really land with you, because there's a lot in it.
Jason, I'm going to leave the final word to you. He's so quotable. There are wonderful humorous quotes, there's political quotes, there's pointed digs, that he has a great turn of phrase, and I think that matters as well, because it connects us when we're reading it. It doesn't feel like a dry old text. It feels something immediate, and the energy, the passion is still there.
Oh, that's absolutely true. And whenever I read it, and I don't always read it through, I just dip in. Everyone has their favourite book. I think most people's favourite book is the first book, Lilliput, which is really what children will know. But every time you read it or you go back, something else will strike you. So Cliona had mentioned the scholar who had spent 8 years upon a project for extracting sunbeams out of cucumbers, and assured Gulliver that with another 8 years he'd finish the research project. And I just think, from an academic background, that's just a fantastic satire. But when I was reading it again in preparation for coming in here, I was struck by when he goes to the Learned Academy, he meets an ingenious architect who had contrived a new method for building houses. And, you know, just thinking about our desire for building more houses in this country at the moment. So what is the ingenious new method? It's by beginning at the roof and working downwards to the foundations. There was a man born blind he meets who was a great artist. And his employment is to mix colours for painters, which he did by feeling and smell, you know. So just in terms of the absurd, but the thing that really struck me, and it finished off, it's pretty much the end of the book, the final line when he's returned from the land of the horses, and it had never struck me before. He has learned to detest human society and prefers the company of horses. And at the end, I was wondering whether the whole book is just not an accurate statement of what has happened to him, but whether Gulliver has actually lost his mind, because he says at the end, "My horses understand me tolerably well, much more than his wife and his children and everyone else. I converse with them at least 4 hours every day."
Well, I think that's a wonderful note on which to end our discussion tonight. My thanks to my brilliant panel of experts, Professor Daniel Cook of the University of Dundee. His wonderful new book, Gulliver's Afterlives, 300 Years of Transmedia Adaptation, has just been published. Dr. Jason McGilligott, the director of Marsh's Library, and that wonderful new exhibition, Gulliver 300, is running in Marsh's Library until September. Dr. Cliona O'Gallagher of UCC, who has published extensively on Swift and is such a brilliant expert. And Professor David Kenny, Professor in Law at Trinity College Dublin, who you can read all about in the current issue of The New Yorker. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Mairéad O'Sullivan, for bringing everything together. We'll be back with more debate and discussion next week. Hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.